WCR Podcast.
Let's talk about the cult of Warren Haynes for a moment. The people who know Warren Haynes have a lot of love for what he does, and for more than 35 years, we've enjoyed watching Warren share his talents with the Allman Brothers Band and later his own group, Government Mule. But he's also been creating an intriguing series of solo releases that feature a lot of what fans love about what he does. But these are also records that find Haynes continuing to explore creatively and push the proverbial boat further out into the water. Million Voices Whisper is the name of his latest solo set, and as I wrote in my original piece for UCR when the album was released this past fall, it is arguably his strongest collection of material to date. His longtime Allman Brothers bandmate Derek Trucks worked on four songs for the album. Three of those songs were co-writes with Derek. Warren also collaborates with the legendary Booker T. Jones on the track Sailin' Shoes, which appears on the expanded edition of the record. And Day of Reckoning is an additional co-write with Lucas Nelson that features Lucas as well as Jamie Johnson on the recording. One of the songs from Million Voices Whisper that's gotten a lot of notice and attention is called Real Real Love, a song which was started by Greg Allman but left unfinished. Haynes, as he tells us during the interview that follows, decided to complete the song to honor Greg's legacy. There are all sorts of great folks playing on this new album. We've mentioned a number of them, but John Medeski from Medeski, Martin, and Wood is somebody else that should be mentioned that we talk about during this conversation. And in short, when you see the liner notes for Million Voices Whisper, you'll know that you are in for a good journey with the album. One more note, Haynes dedicated the new album to his former Allman Brothers bandmate Dickie Betts, who we sadly lost in 2024. So we had a lot to get into, and the first conversation that I had with Warren last October was unexpectedly slightly shorter than our usual interviews. I had the opportunity to have a second chat with Warren about a month later, and because there's not a lot of overlap between the two, we're presenting them both here today for your enjoyment. At the time that we spoke, Warren was getting ready for a few different things, including the All-Star tribute to Robbie Robertson in Los Angeles, which happened on October 17th. And he also organized the Soulshine Hurricane Relief Benefit Concert for Western North Carolina, a massive show at Madison Square Garden that also featured Dave Matthews and other guests. So we talk about both of those past events briefly. Among many other topics, we also discussed Dickie Betts and how important Dickie was to Warren's own career. And Warren and the surviving members of the Allman Brothers are going to pay tribute to Dickie at a special concert in Macon, Georgia next month, an incredible evening that will also feature folks like Susan Tedeschi, Devin Allman, Dwayne Betts, and more. That same month, the Warren Haynes Band returns to the road to play dates in support of Million Voices Whisper. You can find Warren's tour dates at warrenhaynes.net. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, please follow it wherever you're listening so that you'll receive future episodes as they're released. If you enjoy what we're doing here, please rate and review the podcast. We do appreciate it. Here's our conversation with Warren Haynes. I really love this record, and to me, it feels like a mix of a lot of different things, almost as if we're sitting around with you talking about records and you're playing us different things. So in short, there's a lot of things happening here stylistically. If we start there, like, what was in your head when you started thinking about making this record?
Well, I had written a bunch of stuff the last few years that didn't seem like Government Mule songs, but all seemed to kind of have a common feeling or a common thread or feel like they sort of belong together. In the beginning, there was this kind of Muscle Shoals vibe that was somewhere in between Man in Motion and Ashes and Dust. But then the more I continued writing, the more they kind of stayed on the soul music side and maybe added some jazz influence and funk influence and different things. But it doesn't remind me of Man in Motion, but it's more similar to Man in Motion than it would be to Ashes and Dust, for sure. I don't know. I think subconsciously I was just feeling like I wanted to explore a different direction. And from a songwriting standpoint, to make it a little different than anything I had done and just kind of venture into some new territory, you know?
I think that's what I like about it, is it like it feels like several different records at once, but like it all makes sense. And I love the vibe that John Medeski is bringing to all of this. I mean, hearing songs like From Here On Out and Until the Sun Comes Shining Through, like, I think that's something that people have been excited about this record is, you know, the two of you guys being on record. Like, what formed the bond between you two guys originally?
Well, we've been good friends for decades. I think going all the way back to like probably Horde tour days, you know, and
yeah.
The first time I sat in with Medeski, Martin, and Wood was probably 30 years ago or something. And John's always remained one of my favorite musicians. But the last several years, we've both been doing the Last Waltz thing, and we became really close during that and talked about doing more and more stuff together. So I was very excited that he was into doing this and that was able to make time to do it. It was really a blast.
Yeah, I mean, I really kind of can't picture a song like From Here On Out without him on it. Like, it's just amazing. Like, and you can say that about a lot of the folks that you've got playing on this record, but like, he really colors certain songs with a thing that, like, I think only he brings to a record the way that he brings it.
Yeah, and that kind of carries over to the whole project. You know, this was the first time that these four musicians had played together as a unit. You know,
yeah.
I played with Terrence, I played with Kevin, I played with John, but the four of us had never played until January when we went into the studio and started working up these songs. And, you know, we all had an inkling that it was going to be great, but it just kind of came together really quickly and formed its own chemistry. There's like a collective chemistry there that's really special that carries over to the whole album. So everybody's personality shines through, but there's also a band personality.
And before I move off of that, like, you mentioned the Last Waltz stuff that you've been doing in recent years, and later this month you'll be in LA to pay tribute to Robbie at the Life as a Carnival All-Star concert. And, you know, with these shows that you've been doing with the Last Waltz thing in recent years, like, if we look at that original Last Waltz concert, like, for you as a music fan who has now also spent a lot of time with the music, like, what do you think it was that was so special about that night, and why does the Last Waltz continue to captivate music fans to this day the way that it does?
Well, the band's music was so universal and so organic and proved to be timeless, in some cases beyond most other situations from that time period that may have proven to be timeless as well. There's something about the band's music that just is going to live forever. And that event, the original Last Waltz, was the first time anybody had gotten this like star-studded array of musicians to come in and be part of something that was paying tribute to the band's music and to the community that they had developed and to the influence that they had generated over a lot of musicians and songwriters. And the documentary itself was groundbreaking. So everything about that was kind of unprecedented and a wonderful example for people to take into the future, you know?
Well, going back to this new record, how did Derek Trucks come into the mix to work with you on some songs for this record?
Well, that all started with the song Real, Real Love. So Greg Allman had started writing Real, Real Love and never finished it. And after he passed, I found the lyric, which was incomplete, and there was no recorded music for it. So I decided to finish the lyric and write music for it, but to do it in a way that would honor the way I felt like Greg would do it. You know, we wrote enough music together through the years and played enough music together through the years that I felt like I could kind of tap into how he would want the song to sound. And the same with completing the lyric. Once I finished it, it came about rather quickly. And once I finished it, I called Derek and told him about it and said, I think we should go into the studio and record this tune. Initially, I was going to go down to Florida and do it at his place, but his place was under construction. And he was like, I don't know when my studio is going to be finished. I think I might have to come to you. I was like, all right. And then the conversation turned to, well, why don't we get together for a few days somewhere and write some songs and turn this into a whole thing? So he has this farm outside of Macon, Georgia. So I went down there for 3 days and we wrote four or five songs together. And that's all we did was hang out and write music. Two of those songs were These Changes and Hall of Future Saints. And These Changes opens the album. Hall of Future Saints closes the album. They were both really great vehicles for he and I to explore our chemistry together and do what we've done hundreds and hundreds of times on stage. But it was the first time since the Allman Brothers stopped playing that we were able to collaborate this way. And so he came up, we recorded those two songs and Real, Real Love. And we did it, you know, with everybody together in the same room, just like we love to do. And it just really turned out wonderfully. And I'm very happy that we were able to make all this work.
Yeah, we're in this time where it's like, obviously you can, you know, you can do things remotely, but listening to like the way, this is a great headphone record. I want to point that out for people straight away. The way the two guitars are split between the left channel and the right channel on These Changes, that's just a great way to start the record, hearing that in the headphones. But it just feels like it, hearing that song specifically, it feels like it probably added something to have you guys in the same room doing it together rather than doing it remotely.
Oh, absolutely. And that's always my preference if we can make it work. You know, I've been part of some great projects where I had to do it remotely, but I much prefer to be face to face.
What were the challenges for you when it came to getting Real, Real Love right in the image of the way that you were hearing it as far as how Greg would have done it?
Just keeping in mind, you know, what his vision of the song would have been, or, you know, that we're guessing it would have been. For example, bringing the horn section in for that, I just know for a fact that he'd say, oh, we need horns on this, you know. Greg loved working with the horn sections. You know, all the way down to the way I approached it from a vocal standpoint and lyrically as well, I've never done something that was quite so focused on somebody else's personality. You know, I wanted to honor the song as if he were part of it, you know, and his spirit was definitely in the room when we were doing it.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's funny the timing of this, because yesterday we were talking about the version of Midnight Rider that he did for his solo record versus the original one that he recorded with the Allmans. And it's like, having that in mind from thinking about that song yesterday and then listening to what you did with that song today, like, Greg seemed to have an interesting ability to reconsider his own work as well.
Yeah, absolutely. He did that several times, and the reinterpretations were always really different and stood on their own. You know, in some ways, I prefer the laid back version of Midnight Rider, and they're both fantastic, but that version is haunting.
Yeah. And you dedicate this record to Dickie Betts. And I just wondered, like, what your favorite memory was of working with Dickie?
Well, Dickie gave me the biggest opportunity of my career, you know,
for sure.
Dickie hired me in his band, 86, 87. I had no idea at that time that that would lead to me joining the Allman Brothers. But it did. And in 1989, they asked me to join the Allman Brothers when they reformed. And that opened every door imaginable for me. You know, I was such a huge Allman Brothers fan. And as it turns out, every band, every musician in the rock realm has the same sort of reverence for that music that I do, because everyone I met through that experience, it turns out that they looked at the Allman Brothers music the same way we did, you know, and mm-hmm. What an honor to be part of something like that. You know, once I joined the Allman Brothers, there was no closed door that wasn't able to be opened, you know?
Yeah, oh, for sure. You know, man, there was – sorry.
Well, his influence on me as a player and singer and writer as well, a lot of the reason that I dedicated this album to him, aside from the obvious, is that I felt like this music needed for me to play with a little more of his influence than I normally would. So there are several songs where I'm definitely channeling Dickie intentionally.
Yeah. And for you, what was the Dickie thing? Because it's something that we know so well, but like from your perspective, what was that kind of secret sauce that he brought?
Just that flowing melody thing, one note after another, that all feels like you're singing along with the music. You know, his solos had that singing quality and that melodic ease that pulled the listener along, and in turn turned into something that people kind of looked at as being part of the song. You know, the parts that he played were so singable and hummable that even people that didn't play an instrument were like singing along with his guitar solos, you know?
I don't want to go without mentioning Day of Reckoning. And there was a time where protest music obviously was a movement. And I'm guessing you would like to not have to write a song like that. Yet I appreciate that you are one of the folks that chooses to use your platform to implore people to think, look, and consider the things that are going on around us. Like, and so how did that song itself kind of start taking shape?
You know, I got the idea in the middle of the night. I was almost asleep, and I got this idea in my head. So I woke up and sang it into my phone so I wouldn't forget it. And then the next morning when I woke up, I listened to it and was like, oh, this is really cool, and I need to finish it. It's kind of written in a way that is universal. You know, there are a lot of demographics and a lot of causes that could be applied to this lyric. It doesn't go into a lot of specifics. You could look at it about any civil rights issue, but in my mind, it's dealing with the ones that we're still confronting and should not be still confronting, you know. But you could apply a lot of different causes to the lyric. And I feel like you can kind of look at it two different ways, too. It's not meant to be like a violent protest song. It's meant to be like a love and happiness, spread peace and sing along, and, you know, like the 60s mantras were, you know.
For sure, yeah.
And so one of the reasons that I called the record Million Voices Whisper is because that's taken from the chorus of that song, Million Voices Whisper, Getting Louder When We Sing. You know, it's about accomplishing things through music and through spreading the right peaceful vibes, you know?
I want to talk about something that happened recently, and that is the 10th anniversary of the final Allman Brothers Band show, which happened at the Beacon in October of 2014. And something I didn't know until recently was that you're the one that came up with that final set list. And I was interested in reading the liner notes that you stuck to the first six albums as far as the songs you drew on from the band's direct catalog. So I wondered, what was your methodology as far as how you put that set list together? Because it's really one to be proud of.
You know, I think we were mostly just thinking from a historical context what songs we wanted to represent the final show. You know, we had been talking for actually at that point 2 or 3 years about going out on top and at a time when the band was still firing on all cylinders and picking the right location, the right time and place to call it quits. And the set list, I think, was really just about making the most impactful, timeless statement that we could. And I got a lot of feedback and input from various members of the band, especially Derek. Derek and I collaborated on the set list the last few years, quite a bit. And, you know, it sounds like an easy chore, but at that point we had made a practice of playing a different show every night. And so when we would do the Beacon for 10 or 12 or 14 or 15 nights, we wanted every night to be different, but still stand on its own, you know, and there wasn't always an easy thing to do. And we had a lot of special guests joining us, but we knew for that night, we didn't want to, we wanted it just to be us.
Yeah.
And so putting together a set list that we would all be proud that was representative of that band at its finest, you know?
Yeah. And you and I have talked about the various band members in the past, but you're a guy who spent a lot of time playing with Butch and J-Mo. Like, what was special about the dynamic that those two guys has?
The way Butch and J-Mo played together was extremely unique and special, largely because their styles were so different. J-Mo is a much more soft touch jazz style player, and Butch is a harder hitting kind of freight train drummer. And so I think that's what made it work. You know, the two styles meshed, and of course I wasn't around in the beginning, but they talked about it just being kind of an unspoken thing. It just happened naturally and they didn't have to talk about it. And the way they tuned their drums and everything was so different that J-Mo just sounded like an extension of Butch's kit rather than two people doing the same thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, man, when it comes to this new record of yours, Million Voices Whisper, I think something you just said, being able to do something without having to talk about it, I think that's something that I hear a lot in the interplay and various folks that you're playing with on this record. It's honestly one of my favorite albums I've heard from you to date across everything you've done. What kind of set the tone for this album? Because it seems like there can often be a moment that kind of steers where the ship ends up going.
You know, that's a good question. Some of these songs go back to the COVID lockdown, songs like From Here On Out,
yeah,
and Day of Reckoning and Go Down Swinging were all written during that time period and go that far back. The rest of them, for the most part, were written in the last 2 or 3 years. Having said that, the oldest song is Real, Real Love that Greg Allman had started,
sure,
and never finished. And so after I finished writing that song, I called Derek Trucks and told him, hey, I just finished this song that Greg started writing. I really love it. I think we should record it together. And that turned into, hey, maybe we should go in the studio and do several songs together. Which led to let's do some writing. So Derek and I wrote These Changes and Hall of Future Saints together. That whole process kind of led to the overall product, I think.
Yeah, man, and I really appreciate what you did with Real, Real Love. It really does function as a nice tribute to Greg. Like, it seems like it would have been an emotional thing working on that one.
It was very emotional. It came together really quickly when I first started writing it, and that's usually a good sign. That's something Greg and I talked about a lot. When a song comes quick, you're very thankful for it, because they don't always, and it doesn't mean better or worse. Some of the best songs take a long time, but some of them come instantly, and that one kind of did. There was a lot of inspiration. But then when we got into the studio recording it, I mean, his presence was very much felt throughout that whole process. And the fact that we're all in the room together recording, and Derek and I are looking at each other in the same room while we're recording the tune, it made all the difference in the world.
I think you do really capture Greg's voice on that song. And you and I have talked about Greg as a singer in the past, but you kind of just mentioned a little bit of this. Like, what did you appreciate, like, as far as what he brought to the band and perhaps the songs that you would write as a musician and a fellow player?
Well, you know, Greg was one of my favorite singers forever. You know, before I even picked up guitar, I was a fan of Greg's voice. And then once I started playing guitar, I became a huge fan of Duane Allman and Dickie Betts' guitar playing, but it was Greg's voice that pulled me into that music in the first place. And his songwriting style, you know, he had two different personalities musically. He had the laid-back side, where it was the more singer-songwriter side, where he sang in a softer, more pure voice. And he had the shouter blues soul artist side that was fantastic as well. I learned so much from him before I ever met him, and stole so much from him before I ever met him. And I met Greg, I think, in 1981, and we knew each other for a long, long time, wrote a lot of songs together. I learned untold amounts from standing next to him night after night after night, and listening to him sing. It was so unpretentious. He was never singing in an acrobatic way. He was never showing off. He was just letting it pour out of his soul, and that's what the greatest singers do.
How'd you end up writing with Booker T for Sail and Shoes?
Booker T and I wrote that tune together when I was out in L.A. For the Grammys a few years ago, and it was a wonderful opportunity. We've been casual friends for a while, but it was just fell into place. And he has an apartment in L.A., and I went by there, and we spent a few hours together. And the next thing you know, that tune was born. And I got to see him recently when we did the Willie's 90th birthday, and talk about it a bit. I'm just such a fan. He's a beautiful human being, but he's such an amazing part of American musical history.
You mentioned Hall of Future Saints, and that's a monster way to end the record. I hear what sounds like a bullet mic at one point, and it made me wonder, it seems like you had some fun experimenting with various sounds and recording techniques. Are there specific things on this record that stick in your mind, like things you were messing around with?
Yeah, I did wind up using the bullet mic on a few lines in that song, just to kind of pay tribute to that sound. That song is about pointing the finger at influences and where it all comes from. And I think every songwriter at some point writes a song that does that points at where they got it,
Sure.
Where they got it from. And since Derek and I wrote that together, it was all influences that we have in common and that have shaped our lives and our careers. As far as experimenting, I think the thing that I've done the last few records that stands out the most is that I'm using a combination of three amplifiers at the same time. I'll pick three amps, plug into them, get a good sound, and then blend the three of them together. And then we can decide from song to song if one amp seems to work better, or if they work great together equally. But that approach has been working very, very well for me. On this record, I didn't use a lot of different guitars. I mostly used my signature Les Paul and my custom shop Gibson ES-335, as opposed to the last couple of Government Mule records, where I took a ton of guitars into the studio and experimented with a different guitar on almost every song. But it was a fun recording process, and having done three records in a row in that same studio, I'm really comfortable there and love the way it sounds.
Well, last couple things here, man. When we talk about musicians, you've been out on the road this fall with a lot of cool folks, including in particular Ben Montench and Mike Campbell. I wondered what's it been like for you playing with those guys?
Well, both of those guys are fantastic musicians and sweethearts of human beings. It's been fun. Mike Campbell and the Dirty Knobs did a tour with Government Mule a couple of years ago, and that was really fun. Ben Mott and I have played together a handful of times here and there, and he's just one of those rare, eloquent Southern keyboard players that just has such a handle on the history of American music. He's drawing from so many different pools, you know, and he can play so many different genres, but he just has this natural flow about him that is so musical and always seems to serve the song. And Mike Campbell, in a similar way, you know, Mike always manages to play some memorable hook that becomes part of the song, you know, and I love both of those guys.
For sure, for sure. And here's where I'll wrap, man. I appreciate what you have coming up, being part of the benefit show at MSG. Like, you always have been pretty fortunate to be able to use your music to help others going through hard times. And I know for you directly, like, Asheville got hit hard this time around.
Yeah, Asheville and all of Western North Carolina devastated by the Hurricane Helene. And of course, all my family is still there, and I have tons of close friends there. Most of them relocated, and a lot of them, most are back now, but a lot of them just got power and cell service, and in some cases still don't have drinking water.
Oh,
you know, it's been devastating, but everybody's safe and sound, so that's great news. But it's going to be a long process. It's going to take years to rebuild. So the least we can do is to try and raise as much money for the cause as possible.
Well, Warren, man, thank you always for the time. This new album, Million Voices Whisper, I think folks, fellow fans of The Mule and otherwise, everything you've done, are really going to dig this, and, you know, appreciate always your time to talk, sir.
Thank you, man. My pleasure. Nice talking to you.
There you have it. Another episode of the UCR Podcast is in the books. I am Matt Wardlaw. Thank you so much to all of you for listening. Please make sure to follow this podcast if you haven't, so you will get future episodes as they're released. And we'd appreciate it also if you would rate and review the podcast wherever you're listening. Look, we are all music fans, so if you enjoyed this, you can find a lot more at ultimateclassicrock.com, and we'll see you there.